This is File 38, Cycle 2. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is August 9th, 2016. I am interviewing Mr. Joseph Soper, who is going to talk about K&E, slide rules, and anything else that tickles his fancy. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Joe Soper.
Your birth date?
April 17th, 1932. Am I talking loud enough here?
Yep, that's fine. Birthplace?
Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Your parents' names?
May and Lincoln Soper.
And your mother's maiden name was Rudman?
Rudman.
Do you have, or did you have, siblings?
Yes, I have three siblings younger than I am, and they are all passed on. Their names were, starting with the youngest, Jack Soper, Bob Soper, and Don Soper. None married. They stayed single.
Was Jack the nickname for David?
Jack was the nickname for John.
For John.
I might have confused you in the first time when I was talking to you.
I have Donald, I have Robert, and John.
Yeah.
Okay. After high school, you went into the service, and after you got out of the service, you used a GI Bill to get more education.
Yes, that's correct.
And where did you go for this extra education, and what was it?
I tried to advance myself by going to NERC College of Engineering, and when I applied, they said that they couldn't take me. I needed additional education on the report writing and mathematics. And so, using the GI Bill, I went to NERC prep school, and I spent a year there in the during the day and working evenings. And then finally, I had enough credits to be able to go to NERC College of Engineering. It wasn't for a college course, it was for manufacturing course for two-year period in the evenings, three times a week. This was for
manufacturing,
people from industry.
Manufacturing or management?
Management in manufacturing.
Okay. And how did you get hired by K&E?
Well, to back up and go back to the service, I was lucky. In my training, they put me with the Test Pilot Training School in Maryland. Pax River, they called it. And that was my first sighting of slide rules. Every test pilot that came out to our planes to go through the test program had a K&E slide rule. And what confounded me back then was they could use a slide rule while flying a jet single-handed. And I had to question, how do you do this? They said, oh, we just put the stick between our knees and fly, and they can actually do calculations on the plane, which was fascinating. Anyway, that was the sighting of my first K&E slide rule. So after I came out of the service, I worked for Color Reproductions, which was a screen printing company in New Jersey. And I was there for, 16 years, including the time in the service. When I came out, I went back there with them, and I had reached a level where I felt there was no place to go, and I thought, well, I gotta move on to increase my ability to raise more money and a better job. And I just, at that time, I read an article in the New York Times that Coifel-Nestor Company was looking for someone to set up an advertising specialty department. And it required people with a knowledge of screen printing, which I did have, and hot roll leaf stamping and engraving, so that all their products could be somehow, companies could have their names engraved or printed, and these could be executive gifts that they could give out to raise business. Well, this is an advantage for K&E simply because instead of selling them one at a time over a counter, they could sell hundreds at one time. And so they found it very profitable, and we set up. I was supposed to, if I'm getting ahead of myself, say something here.
Well, when were you hired? What year were you hired?
At K&E.
At K&E.
Okay, that goes back to 1966.
That's
in November.
What I'm looking for. Okay. And when you came to Lakeville, where did you work first? What building?
I was in, when I was coming to Lakeville, first of all, I have to back up a bit here. Fred Leubischer was having some difficulties with sidewalls.
We're going to get to Fred.
Oh, you will?
But, yeah.
Okay.
But tell me the building.
The first building I went in was in Lakeville. It was the main shop on the pond.
You told me it was the town garage on Porter Street.
That was after they found a situation for me.
Okay.
The first place would be next to the pond, and then I would cross the road and go up on the third floor.
All right, you're talking about Pocket Knife Square.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I've got to get the locations.
Okay. No.
All right, and then you went over to the town garage on Porter Street.
That came about 1 year later.
Okay.
And we rented that for a few years.
Now, K&E headquarters are in Hoboken, New Jersey.
That's correct.
Okay. And they had three other states that they had plants in.
More than that, but I think I mentioned...
You mentioned three.
Three possibilities for me.
Okay. And they were which three?
That was in Salisbury Products, which was the one I ended up in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one in Cape May, New Jersey.
Yep.
And one in Kennebunkport, Maine.
Those are the three.
So those were the three choices.
And you developed the advertising specialty department.
That's right.
Okay. Now, at Pocket Knife Square, there were three brick buildings. There was the building that was the Holly Manufacturing.
That's right.
And there was a small brick building beside that.
That's right.
And then across the street, which used to be the forge for the Salisbury Iron Works, that was a brick building.
I think it was the Holly Pocket Knives.
Yeah.
That were in
but
there.
But those are the three buildings.
Those are the three main buildings.
Okay. All righty. Now tell me about Fred Leubischer.
Well, Fred Leubischer came up to Connecticut from New Jersey. He lived in Essex Fells, New Jersey. And he decided to semi-retire and move out of that area up to Turkey Hill. I'm not sure that's a designation in Lakeville or not, but that's what he called it, Turkey Hill.
Where was that located?
Up off Belgo Road. You ever hear that?
Was it on Belgo Road, or was it on Reservoir Road, or was it on...
Belgo Road goes up, Reservoir Road
goes across.
Was at right angles.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there, and I'm
okay.
Not sure exactly where.
But
he had an area called Turkey Hill.
It may have been, and I'm guessing, where Shag Roy's farm was, which was a turkey farm. And that's...
Makes sense.
That's up. Okay. All right. Because in the book that you gave me, a girl named George, she talks about Turkey Hill, but doesn't specify.
Where, yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Now, Fred came up from Essex Falls, New Jersey, and what was it?
It's Essex Fells, F-E-L-L-S.
Okay, Essex Fells. Was he hired by K&E?
No. He only knew the vice president of K&E. He was friendly because he lived in Essex Fells. And Fred was a civil engineer, and he did work for Mr. Koifel.
Mm-hmm.
Doing landscaping and that type of thing. Well, when Fred and George came up here, they got an interest into the local industries. They decided to see if they could restore that to a paying business. And once they got into that business, Fred and George threw their hearts into it. And they managed to get a company that made cutlery. I don't know the name of the company, but they wanted beautiful maple boxes. And Fred set up an operation in that building in local industries to make these boxes.
Maple, not cherry?
It could have been cherry, too. I had
okay.
several of them, and I couldn't make up my mind which was cherry or which was maple, but...
Now, when Fred was running the local industries in that company, they were making Harvey lures.
Harvey lures, yeah.
And they were also doing skis.
They were doing skis and other fishing equipment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's as far as I know. They could have done other things.
But those are the two prime that
that's
I was looking
the prime,
for.
Prime, yeah.
Okay.
Now, he didn't own the business. They just bought into it. Mm-hmm. They bought stock in it. Eventually, when he went to K&E with the tongue and groove concept for K&E Instruments, he had already set up local industries to do this work.
Right.
For the cutlery company. And he thought, well, gee, let's see if we can move on and get additional work. So he talked with Mr. Keufel and asked for a box to be sent up that he could quote on. And they were made out of mahogany down in New Jersey. So Fred sharpened his pencil, and he did a quote on the box, and they went down to Hoboken and presented it to the buyer. And the buyer said, you know, how do you arrive at this price? And Fred said, he went through the steps, and they said, you make the box 6 minutes less time than we take down here in Hoboken. And Fred said, well, in that case, I want to raise my price a little bit, which he did, and they were perfectly happy because their response was, we want our suppliers to make money. And after that point, they got a lot of boxes to be made by local industries. Fred was told by Mr. Keufel that if you can get control of local industries, buy out the other stockholders, would you be willing to do work for us that goes beyond just boxes? And Fred said he thought he could. And K&E offered to start a company called Salisbury Products, K&E Salisbury Products, provided Fred can get control of the company. And then K&E would buy him out with a 60-40 proposition. Fred would own 40%, K&E would own 60%.
But there was also a buyback clause, wasn't there?
There was a buyback clause. K&E would buy the company outright, mm-hmm. for, they had a term, book value, or,
right.
or what the other term, you probably
yep.
have that there. And he agreed to it. And then K&E established a fund to build the factory that you see there now.
And why was that necessary?
Because of the amount of work that was going to come up from Hoboken.
And also, I believe you said they were going to work with celluloid, and
well,
they needed
celluloid,
a sprinkler system.
Yeah, they were going to work with the celluloid. Fred said, no, we don't have a facility where you can work with an explosive material such as that. We don't have sprinklers, we don't have fire doors. And that's when K&E made the offer to build a factory with those that equipment mm-hmm. right in, mm-hmm. which they did. And Fred was still 40% owner of that building, too.
Yep.
So that's how it got started. And this all happened before I came up here.
Mm-hmm.
I came up in 66, mm-hmm. and I was on board in Lakeville by 67, January 67.
Can you tell me about Dick Bianchi?
Yeah, Dick was already working for a tire company up in Detroit, Michigan, when he was asked to take on a role as a manager with a paper coating company up there K&E owned. It was paper and film. Mm-hmm. And so he went into that job, and when Fred expanded the Lakeville plant to the point where he couldn't do everything he wanted to do and needed help, Dick Bianchi was asked to come down, transfer to Lakeville, and fill the position of production manager in this plant. Fred would still be plant manager.
Okay.
Now, on the wall was a flow chart, and I distinctly remember a dotted line that went from the president of the company down to Dick Bianchi around Fred Lakeshore. that pretty much ran the business. Fred was free to come up with projects and ideas for improving the process. And it stayed that way for quite a while. When I came on board, the first thing they asked me to do, forget about advertising specialties. You've got to work on our slide rule problem.
And what was the slide rule problem?
They were using a process. All the slide rules up until the time the operation came to Lakeville were made of mahogany with a celluloid coating, and they were engraved in Hoboken. And women sat around a table painting in the color, and then with a fine steel wool they would buff it off, and that's how they got the color into the ivory or the celluloid. Well, now they were starting an entire new project up here in Lakeville. It was going to be molded plastic slide rules. They were trying desperately to get away from mahogany, because about one third of mahogany slide rules had to be tossed because of warping.
Yep.
And I don't know whether to inject this at this point in time, but the idea came to K&E to mold slide rules using the process that was used to make 78 long play records.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the process they swiped, I guess, or took on loan to make their own process. The masters for the slide rules were engraved in Hoboken. Very careful engraving.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were sent out to be plated with iron. I don't know if this is the process you want to go through.
Not particularly.
Okay.
In that, eventually we're going to get to the Leroy lettering part.
Okay. Anyway, we got into the slide rule business in Lakeville. That was the primary business. We were the premier manufacturer of slide rules in the United States at that point.
And was that Salisbury Products? Part of Salisbury Products?
That was Salisbury Products.
What was the staff? How many staff did you
have? We had, I can remember seven, but there were a couple that came and went.
Chet Patchen?
Chet Patchen was our, I always said, the most important guy, because when things went wrong, call Patchen.
Ah.
And he'd come and resolve the problem, because he designed and built many of the manufacturing machines. A wonderful guy. Not everybody got on his sweet side, but for some reason I did. And anything I wanted, all I had to do was mention it. I didn't tell him how to do it.
Yeah, that's,
all I had to
yep.
do was ask him, could this be done? And next thing I know, he lay things on my desk, all done.
That works very well.
Yeah.
And there was a lady named Marion Smith?
Marion Smith, I got her. I had to judge who I could use for screen printing slide rules.
Mm-hmm.
She seemed to have a lot of patience, and she lived in Millerton. Her husband was in refrigeration, I believe. At any rate, she worked for K&E during the day, assembling parts and pieces for K&E. And I realized that she looked like she was a talented person that could do screen printing. So I asked Marion, would she like to get into this business? And she said, sure, she's willing to do anything different,
mm-hmm.
you know, because she liked to fool with color. She used to do watercolors or something, and this was a graphic arts that she wanted to be in, and she worked out very well. Right up to the end of slide rules, she was doing the printing for us.
Okay.
Now, there was a point, I don't know if this is getting ahead of the story, there was a point where Koifunosa Company built a new general office's headquarters in Morristown, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved everything from Hoboken. All the management and everybody went up there, leaving space in Hoboken that they wanted to utilize. A new company had bought out K&E. It was called the Kratos Company.
Yep.
Kratos came from California. They were in the aerospace business. And for some reason, they decided to buy K&E. And the children of the founders and the uncles of the company at that point in time decided they want to get out and they want to take the money and run.
Mm-hmm.
golden parachute type thing, which they did, and Kratos took over the company. At that point in time, Kratos made the decision, we're going to bring K&E Salisbury back to Hoboken.
Right.
And that came like a lightning bolt out of the blue. None of us could believe it. We did our best to convince them to leave it alone.
That was in 69?
That was in 69.
Okay.
Close to 69.
Yeah.
And we did everything we could to convince them not to do it. They desisted on it. At that point in time, Fred was let go as plant manager, and he became a
consultant
to K&E, and they would use him for projects anywhere in the country. And at that point, Dick Bianchi took on a job as plant manager in New Jersey for a coating plant, film and coating plant. Everybody else in management was asked to go down to New Jersey during the week to Hoboken and come home weekends for their families.
Now, did you go to Hoboken or did you go over to Millerton?
No, it was interesting because I told Dick Bianchi, I said, you know, tell the management that I'm not interested in going back to New Jersey. I had built a house down there, I sold it and come up here, and we built another home 3 years later, they were asking me to go back, and I said, I talked to my wife, and we dug our heels in, and we said, we're not going back. Well, after that, I got a call from George, oh, what's his name, personnel director, I can't come up with his name.
That's all right.
I probably gave it to you there. Anyway, he invited my wife and I out to dinner, along with Fred Leibischer and George Leibischer. And we all went over to a place in Armenia to have a really nice dinner. And I thought, well, I told my wife, they're going to try to talk me into going to New Jersey. And she said, we don't want to go. I said, fine. When we got there, they surprised me. They offered me the job at Millerton, New York. Mm-hmm. And I could take the screen printing operation over there and stay up here. I could continue to live in Lakeville.
And that plant building is across from Agway.
Correct. It's a big place.
Yes, it is.
Really big.
Okay. And did K&E come back to Lakeville?
Well, 1 year later, I was working in Taconic, doing the same, printing slide rules and sending them down to New Jersey to be processed, along with the advertising specialty business. And at that point in time, the K&E operation that went to Hoboken turned into a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
They were over $2 million, which dollars were bigger back then.
Yeah, they sure were.
And in back orders. They had the orders, they didn't have the product. Now, I got to say that Gordon Card went down to set up the operation. And he was so frustrated because they couldn't get people locally that can do the operation, run the equipment. And that's why they fell so far behind. It wasn't Gordon's problem. It was the people could not be trained to do these jobs. Then the decision was made to return back to Lakeville.
Mm-hmm.
When Lakeville closed, Fred Leibischer went in and bought all the buildings.
Smart move. Mm-hmm.
Did absolutely nothing with the building. All the wires, cables, plumbing, and everything was in the same positions as when they picked up the operation and moved it. Fred said, sure. They came up, they worked a deal. Fred said he wanted two 5-year leases and with an option to renew. K&E agreed out of desperation. He had no choice but to bring it back. I was asked to leave the Millerton plant, the Taconic Products plant, and return to Lakeville as general foreman.
Right.
Because I had all that experience that I could use. Dick Bianchi was asked to come back from New Jersey to the plant as plant manager. Fred was still on a retainer to the company, but Dick Bianchi was then plant manager of the whole thing. And I was his general foreman. Everything within 3 days, we had everything hooked up after the riggers left, and we were back in producing slide rules and Leroy products in Lakeville. It was a marvelous move.
Tell me a little bit about the Leroy lettering.
Leroy lettering, that was the biggest money producer the company had, and that goes for the whole company. We had a product that could be engraved. Our engraving was top-notch. And we could engrave these templates. Engraving was done one at a time on a single spindle machine. Fred Leubischer has to take credit for designing a machine that can do six at a time. In the same time it takes to do one, he could get six. And that machine was built by an outside company. And Fred said, you know what? Given the resources, I can build an eight-spindle machine here, right in the plant, using Chet Patchen and his machine shop, which he did. And that machine worked beautifully. In the time it takes a single engraver to do one template, we could end up with seven or eight. That was so good, he decided to move on. And he then built a 16-spindle machine.
Good heavens.
Yeah. Or 17, I'm sorry, 17-spindle machine. Everybody went, what? And he says, yeah, it can be done. Caney didn't buy the idea. They sent up their own engineers to see what Fred had to say about it and how he was going to do it. And he managed to convince the engineers to put the money in the project. It can work. And Fred made the first one, and it worked so well that they made two more.
Oh, good.
We had such capacity for Leroy lettering. Now, there were other companies that made Leroy-type templates, but there was no way in the world they could engrave at the rate we did.
Because of the machinery.
Because of the amount of machines and the production.
Did you started the print department to put logos on slide rules? And then there were the boxes that were made for cutlery first and then for precision tools. And then you have the Leroy lettering process. Did they make other precision drafting instruments as well as slide rules?
Yeah, but they were not unique to Caney. A lot of companies made triangles, flex curves, T-squares, all this stuff. And so that wasn't unique to
Caney. That wasn't unique to Caney.
Right. But the engraved templates were unique to
Caney. They
were. And the slide rules were unique to K&E.
And what happened in 1976?
76, did I give you that date?
Yep, when they stopped producing slide rules.
Okay, I needed a reminder.
And that was a bolt out of the blue.
That was. Did I give you the name of the fellow that designed and built the first four-function electronic calculator?
No.
Because that ultimately was the cause of the demise of slide rules. Can I give you his name?
Yep.
And tell I think me that's what, important because...
And tell me what he did.
Ironically, a fellow, you can have this by the way, by the name of Robert Reagan.
How do you spell the Reagan?
R-A-G-E-N.
R-A-G-E-N, okay.
Yeah. Of San Leandro, California, invented the first four-functional electronic calculator using a Kieffel-Nesser Decillon slide rule made right here in Lakeville, Connecticut.
This slide rule helped to design the very machine that would ultimately render us obsolete in slide rules.
Okay. All right. So Robert Reagan is an important name.
Yeah. He died a few years ago. He worked for another company, but he was credited with using transistors. Remember the early transistors?
Yes.
To make
yes.
a four-function calculator.
Right.
Well, later on, integrated circuits took that job over, but he was the first to produce a calculator.
And because of producing the calculator, they no longer made the slide rules.
It took a few years, yeah. but eventually slide rules ran out.
Okay.
And each year the production was less and less. Schools were a little bit reluctant to switch from slide rules to the calculators.
Not only were they
expensive, but somehow it seemed that the professors were so used to using slide rules, they resisted the idea.
Well, sure. You use what you're used to.
That's right. Anyway, eventually, of course, it replaced slide rules.
Now, I have these figures that K&E at the beginning had about 3,000 employees.
That's the Hoboken.
The Hoboken.
The whole shamir. Hoboken and all the outlying companies.
By 1985, there were only 700 employees left.
In 1985, Kratos had made a mess of the company.
Yep.
They were selling off parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out long before that sometimes the parts are worth more than the whole, and they were making money by selling off divisions. They also went bankrupt. It was a leveraged buyout. Many banks had loaned money to Kratos to buy K&E. Now the banks were stuck with K&E. They renamed the company back to K&E again and went out looking for another buyer. This new buyer was a company called Azon. Azon was in the business of paper and film production for engineers, designers, draftsmen. Mm-hmm. And they were located in Binghamton, New York. Anyway, they wanted K&E for the machinery for coating. They didn't want anything else. Somehow, and I don't know how, we managed to convince them that little Lakeville was making money. We were making the templates, Leroy. And so they decided, okay, we're not going to dump Lakeville plant, but they're going to keep it as long as we're profitable. It was about that time that Dick Bianchi decided to retire. He was, I guess it was 1985, mm-hmm. he decided to step aside. He had like 34 years experience with K&E, and it was time to step aside. I was named plant manager at that point.
For the product manager or plant manager?
No, plant manager.
I thought that was in 87.
I went back to him as a... He was the plant manager, took over from Fred. I was his manager on the floor.
Because what I read in the information that you gave me was that you were product manager in 85, and then in 87 you became plant manager.
Well, that could have been.
Okay.
Because Ken Craver was plant manager in Millerton, and they wanted him to oversee Salisbury. But he wasn't there. I was running the place, and I drifted right in. They let him go, and when they closed the Millerton plant and moved it out,
mm-hmm.
he was let go, and the company made me the plant manager for Lakeville.
Okay.
And that stayed that way until 85, when Dick Bianchi stepped out, and we moved the plant at that time over to Canaan, Connecticut.
That was in 1990.
90, yeah.
Yep. And that's, you went up to Canaan then?
Yeah, I went to Canaan. I took the operation. We dumped everything, all the equipment that was unnecessary for Leroy
mm-hmm.
was dumped, sold off, just gotten rid of. And we moved.
Keep going.
Is that okay?
Yep, keep going. I'm just checking it.
Okay. That all the things that we didn't need. They didn't have space enough over at the Gies Sign Shop. We took 2/3 of that big building they put up over there. And we moved in only the Leroy operation.
The Gies Sign Shop is on Route 7.
Yeah, that's up just near the police barracks.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And we stayed there for 5 years. Mm-hmm. We had a lease for 5 years. And then another company Azon decided to get out of the Leroy business because they were also bailing out with their clauses. And they put the Leroy up for sale. And a guy from Binghamton, New York, who had an injection molding plant, decided to come down and buy the operation. I don't know the name of the company, but he was happy to get it. Mm-hmm. It was sold for pennies on the dollar.
Naturally.
And he was going to move it out of Canaan to Binghamton, wanted me to go to Binghamton with the product line because I was the manager. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm not going to sell a move to Binghamton. Oh, no, you don't have to sell. You can come out here, spend a week, and come home weekends. I said, that's not going to work. No. I'm too old for this business. And I stepped aside, and I decided to slip into retirement.
In 1995.
Yes.
And you were kept on as a consultant for 6 months?
I was hired back as a consultant until the sale was made. I had to be there I was a private contractor, really.
Yeah.
And I stayed on until they were going to move the plant. And I stepped aside and called it quits. I could add one thing at this point.
Please.
What a roller coaster ride I had with the company. First with K&E, then Kratos, back to K&E, then on to Azon Corp. Over almost 30 years, I never missed one paycheck, never had to move my family once.
Well done.
Which was unusual.
And very.
I'm proud of that fact that they felt the need to keep me on.
And you were a very valuable employee.
I like to think that.
You were?
Because they never tested me.
They tested you and you came up just fine. Before we close, I do want you to tell the story about the spider lady in Hoboken.
Okay. Early on, when K&E built the manufacturing plant in Hoboken, they made a lot of instruments that were used for surveying. And one of the biggest needs was for a hairline fine enough that the crosshairs would look very sharp in the magnifying glass of the bomb site, the black box during the war.
Yep.
They made that equipment. And all service, any kind of surveying instruments, they had a building on top. It looked like an astronomy building. They used to test their equipment by reading something on the building in downtown Manhattan.
Okay.
And they had to get fine enough crosshairs to zero in on a particular point, but they couldn't manufacture a hair that fine. And so how it was determined that a spider web would serve the purpose if they could collect the spider webs, wash them, carbonize them, and then they could be used for crosshairs. And so they hired a woman who didn't mind being around slide rules. It was in the bottom of the Hoboken building, and somewhere I have a picture of this. She would just dump all these spiders on, they'd run around, it was glass walls, and they couldn't climb the glass, and she would poke at them with a glass rod until she picked up one of the webs. Then she'd lift the spider up. Of course, the spider was making web trying to get down, and she'd just wind it up until it ran out of web, I guess. And then she would let that spider go, another glass rod, and she'd do the same thing. And then these spider webs were somehow cleaned and then put in a process that they could be carbonized to make them black. Mm-hmm. And they were finer than anything a human could make at that time.
Oh my.
And these were used in all of the crosshairs of all the instruments they made. Fascinating.
That's fascinating.
And her name was Mary. Mary the Spider Lady.
Oh, wonderful.
I never saw her, never met her, but I've heard people talk about it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I enjoy saying all this stuff.